The Charlotte Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Let's do a podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of the Charlotte Podcast. This is John.
And this is Miller in this episode 253. Johnny boy, what's on this week's episode?
So this week, we have local author Landis Wade, host of the Charlotte Readers Podcast, and author of the book that we've both read about the MacDeck Deadly Declarations.
Yeah, it's a really,
I have
really
a great conversation with him.
I enjoy the book. I think it was a fantastic conversation about the process of writing the MacDeck and then also how fun this book is. And we brought back rapid fire questions, which was a lot of fun.
We did.
John, what else?
Quick question. Okay, have we ever endorsed a book like Oprah's Book Club? Have we ever done that?
Probably like Scott Seifert's book, which we talk about on this podcast.
True. Joining the pantheon of books that we've endorsed over the years, I'd say Deadly Declarations is up there.
I'm generally pro all books. I think books aren't bad. What are you reading right now? Is there a book you're reading?
No. I mean, I've read Deadly Declarations. Right now, I don't know, man. These kids are draining me of my life force. So what are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book about Chernobyl because that's the things. I also have a great podcast recommendation I started listening to. I don't know if I told you about it. It's called, what's the name of this? Sorry, I'm pulling it up just to make sure. It's called Well, There's Your Problem. All they do is just engineering disasters. And it's just, they have slideshows. You don't need to see the slides. They just go through 5 hours of what actually happened to the Titanic.
So it's just the Challenger, the O-rings on the Challenger for 5 hours.
Yep, there's a Challenger episode where they talk about the space shuttle and how it's like so stupid that we made a space shuttle that didn't ever accomplish its mission. It's very funny. You would enjoy it.
All right, I'll check it out.
Much better than this podcast. John, cheers and jeers. We're also doing that this week?
Yes. We'll end with that.
Awesome. Well, you can listen to us on any podcasting platform. Please leave a rating or review if you have not. It helps. We need your validation. Also, I'm checking right now. If you do leave reviews or notes to us via reviews on iTunes, we'll start reading them out loud if I remember. So I'm checking. When we get back on the break, I will let you know if we have any reviews. So what you hear next is our conversation with Landis Wade.
All right, we are here with Landis Wade, local author and host of the Charlotte Readers Podcast. Welcome, Landis, to the Charlotte Podcast with one less word. Welcome aboard. We're so glad you're here.
Hey guys, look, man, y'all were my inspiration. Before I was even a podcaster, I was listening to you guys, and somebody just said, "Why are you going to do a podcast?" Well, let's just do a podcast. You know, let's just do a podcast. And y'all were
that's right.
So happy to be on here and talk about books and podcasting.
You saw how easy and how lo-fi a podcast can be, and said, "I can top this."
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, anybody can do this, right? You know.
Yeah, literally. Exactly. You know how famously the Velvet Underground, like the album that they had, like inspired a bunch of other bands. Like that's our podcast, where like how bad, how like low fidelity we are, gave everybody a chance to realize how low the bar is. So that's us. We're the Velvet Underground, is what I'm trying to say.
You're an inspiration.
That's right. Well, Landis, we have so much to get to. We're so excited that you're here. We brought back. So much like you, I imagine, during the pandemic, we've been doing this virtually, like we're recording virtually now. We haven't done as much of a segment that Miller and I love to do, which is our rapid fire questions. But we had to do right by you and how excited we are to have you on. And so we're bringing back our rapid fire questions a little bit later. So very excited for that. But to get started here, I mean, we would love to hear just like, what's your relationship to Charlotte? Like, how did you come to be in the city and doing the Charlotte Readers podcast and all the other stuff that you're doing? Kind of take us on the Landis Wade journey.
Yeah, well, I've been here a long time. I'm like my character in my book. I'm about to approach 65, and I've been in Charlotte, except for when I went off to college and law school, pretty much all those years except one. I was born in Chapel Hill, came to Charlotte, grew up here, went to public schools, went up to Davidson and Wake Forest Law School, and then came back and practiced law here in Charlotte as a trial lawyer for 35 years. And then, you know, I was coaching and doing Pop Warner football and league baseball and coaching basketball and doing all the things that I thought I wanted to do. And then when the kids went off and, you know, it's time to get serious about life, I thought, hey, I need to do something fun. I'm going to start writing some books. And then I'm going to do something I know nothing about. I heard these guys doing this thing called the Charlotte Podcast. I think I'll start a podcast because I know nothing about podcasting. So that was, you know, Charlotte has been important in my life. My parents, you know, lived here for many years. My grandfather was a sports writer. He was the sports editor of the Charlotte News and the Charlotte Observer for about 15 years.
Oh,
the 30s and 40s. And then he became the first, you know, he did that public press thing for UNC Chapel Hill, became their sports information director, the first they had during the days of Charlie Choo-Choo Justice and into the 50s. So I hope I've got the gene somewhere, because he had something called the Jake Wade Sports Parade, and people seemed to enjoy it back in the 30s and 40s. So I'm just trying to take that into this next century.
Wow. So you come by it honestly, it sounds like. You got at least ink, it used to be before it was all digital, ink in your blood, sounds like, as far as the writing goes.
Yeah, I'm using a keyboard and a modern computer. They had to clack it out in the old typewriter days, which is kind of interesting. Y'all probably remember that one time. You get the little white out and you put it on the page. And I don't know how we ever got anything finished typing papers in school. But no, it's been a fun journey. You know, lawyers write all the time. We usually write things that people don't care to read because we're long-winded and don't get to the point. They call the papers we file in court briefs. I don't know whoever came up with that, because they're not brief. they go on for a long time. And so I tell people, you know, lawyers need to start thinking about writing like fiction writers, because it would be much more interesting and you wouldn't bore people to death.
Well, so you call yourself a recovering trial lawyer. I'm interested in kind of, especially with that legacy, I didn't realize kind of the legacy of your family history of writing. What kind of led you to make the switch? Like, did you always have the call of writing, or was it kind of a crisis, or like how did you decide to make that switch?
Well, like most people coming out of college in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, right? No, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So it was either going to be, maybe I'll go be a journalist, maybe I'll go be of this. Well, I don't know, maybe I'll go do something for about a year, six different things, which I did. And then I said, you know, maybe I'll just go back to school. Oh, I know, I'll go to law school. So I chose law school. It turned out to be pretty good decision for me to go law school first and writing second instead of writing first, because now I was in a position in my early 60s to actually, you know, create these nonprofit organizations called Writer and Podcaster.
Very cool. So you transitioned to, so take us through kind of your career an author, kind of like, how does that work? What baffles me, so I've done a little writing, Miller's done some writing as well. There's actually the two of us meeting has to do with writing for kind of local newsletters and stuff. But I'm amazed at anybody that can write an entire book. So how do you even get the confidence to do that? And kind of how did you get your start once you started saying like, hey, I'm going to try to put this whole thing together that isn't writing briefs and writing books that people might read?
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, one step at a time with anything. Don't try to bite it off all at once. But back in the, I was about 56 years old. I was, you know, thinking about what I wanted to do. And I was at the end of the year, it was around Thanksgiving time. And my wife had Miracle on 34th Street on in the other room. And I was in my study writing a short story like I would do about that time of year. that might turn into a novel that never got finished because I would go back to work in January and, you know, forget about what I'd written. But I heard that scene in Miracle on 34th Street where the lawyer comes in and puts all the mail on the table and proves that, you know, this Kris Kringle is the one and only Santa Claus. And I thought, I wonder if I could write a mystery about Christmas set entirely in a courtroom that takes place over a period of about 2 days. I'm going to make this lawyer who's a sole practitioner have to represent somebody who thinks he works for Santa Claus. So I made it a contemporary story, started writing. I wrote feverishly every night between, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And Christmas Eve at 11 o'clock, I'm printing this thing out, binding it up, putting it under the tree for the family. And the next morning you thought I would have given them socks or something for Christmas. It was like that big an impression on what I'd done. But then the story got out and a couple people saw it and I thought, okay, they liked the story. Maybe I'll go get an editor. And I got an editor and I fixed the things that were wrong with it. And I published it as a book the next year, sort of a novella length, not a full-blown novel, but then it was so much fun, I decided to write a second in the series, and then I had an idea about how to make it a trilogy the next year. So I wrote those first three books, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year. They all came out at Christmas, and it's really, the books are a cross between My Cousin Vinny and Miracle on 34th Street. So they all they all have happy endings, but they got a lot of snarky stuff. And you got witnesses that are elves, and you got witnesses that are evildoers who don't believe in Christmas and this kind of thing. And so, you know, this sole practitioner has to prove Christmas is real, or Christmas won't come for you know, hundreds of thousands of kids. So that was fun. I had a good time doing it. And then I got to be approaching 60, 61, and this thing called podcasting was out there. I was listening to a lot of podcasts, listening to y'all's podcast, listening to others. And I was like, you know, I've always wanted to be on the radio. I know what I'll do. I'll go start a podcast and I'll interview authors because, you know, what better way to find out about how to write than to ask them the questions and steal good ideas from them. And so that was the idea. I started a podcast featuring other authors' work, Charlotte Riss Podcast, and, you know, just started slow and put out a season in 2018 at the end of the year, and then got more serious about it when I retired and really started trying to branch out. Now I've interviewed authors in 30 states and 3 countries, and I just released 292nd episode. And the thing about it is I've learned so much and I've met so many interesting people. But had I not done that for 3 years, hosting that podcast and interviewing those authors, I would not have been able to write the full-length novel we're talking about tonight, because it actually did so much you know, for me, in terms of teaching me about the craft of writing.
Now, Landis, I was going to comment on how appreciative are that you're calling out our podcast and thanking us, but did you just drop that you've done more episodes than us? Was that just, did you just like humbly stunt on us a little bit right there?
You guys were so far ahead of me. I said, you know, my goal in life is to try to have more podcasts than the Charlotte. No, you know, what happened was COVID happened, right? And, I had nothing else to do, so I was putting out a bunch of podcasts, and y'all are still having to work, I'm sure, and so I cheated a little bit and get ahead.
Fine. We'll just say with our combined, we're approaching 600.
I like the combined.
Landis, take us through, so you say you did this first series you did, and we'll get into the new book next, but you wrote a book each year, and you've talked to so many authors, you kind of, I imagine the answer is every author has a different process, but what's your process going about in writing a book? And it seems like you like to bring things in from your personal life or things you observe and things like that.
Yeah, so people sometimes say, you know, if it's a kind of a cheap way out to write what you know, but actually there's a lot of great material when authors write what they know, because they can bring this realism to the page. I mean, if you want to read a spy novel, right? Wouldn't it be great if the author was a spy? You know, they know some things that are going on. So I thought, I'm going to write a little bit about what I know, which is what is the law practice like, you know, when someone's approaching 60, 65 years old, they've got a lot of experience and they're having to transition to their next act. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But in terms of the process, because podcasting takes time, as you guys know, in terms of the scheduling and everything you do with it, the pre and the post activity, I did not have a very good schedule. People say write every day. I say do what works for you. And I'm more of a binge writer. I had to find my through line for this book. I had to find what really excited me. And once I did, you know, I was kind of off to the races in terms of getting that first draft done. But it took me 3 years on this book because I was just kind of starting and stopping. And maybe when we talk about the book itself, I can tell you what, you know, kind of really got me energized. It was actually, I'll just jump to it. I interviewed Scott Seifert, who y'all know, who wrote the nonfiction book about the Met.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and by interviewing Scott, I said, hey, Scott, man, there's just too much good stuff here. There's too many conspiracies. And this should be a novel. Are you going to write the novel? And he said, no. And I said, okay, well, and then he said, why don't you write it? And I said, done, as long as you take a look at it and make sure I don't mess up the history.
So, I've said that to Scott, too.
So what it sounds like is Scott has confirmed that everything that happens in your book really did take place with the Mech Deck.
Yeah, Scott's a believer, as you know, in the Mech Deck. And but in fairness to Scott, in fairness to what I did in the book, there are two sides to this story. You guys have covered it. I actually went back into your archives. I think it's I'll get people to go back and listen earlier. But your 125th episode, y'all did a little thing on the Mech Deck. I think John did some research, and you know, y'all did this thing where you talked about the five important things about. And what you found in that research, I'm sure, is that you can make arguments on both sides of this issue of was the Mech Deck real or not. And what a perfect platform story for a novel, because novels are about conflict. They're about, you know, people arguing about what's true and what's not. And so to have that as a springboard for a novel was just exciting to me. And that's what really got me off of this earlier, just writing a little bit and podcasting and suddenly saying to myself, I need to go away for 3 weeks, which I did at the end of about a year ago, and I wrote 60 or 70,000 words in that 3 week period. And so when I got back, I had a pretty good first draft.
Wow. That's incredible. I like that you say you write what you know. And that kind of takes me back. John mentioned we both used to write. I was writing about dog tender when I was single. So that was me writing about what I knew. This book, I loved it. And I, going back to the write what you know, I was telling you before we started recording, it was like I kept finding little Easter eggs of parts of Charlotte that I love, and kind of we'll get into that, but give us what is the inside of the cover description of what this book is? What should people, what are they getting into when they pick up Deadly Decorations?
All right. So this is a mystery that's set in the modern day in what I like to call the New South City of Charlotte. We've got three unlikely heroes here. You know, it's a trio of retirees, and they work at this fictional retirement community that I call the Independence Retirement Community, the Indy for short. And they have to solve two mysteries that come about and are identified very early in the book. A 96-year-old resident at the Indy dies, and when they find his body, his manuscript on the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence is missing, this book he's working on. And they also find a handwritten will where he leaves his $50 million fortune to the most despised resident at the Indy, Sue Ellen Parker, and he cuts out his beloved granddaughter, you know, and there you are. And so Craig Travail entered the picture. He's the lawyer. He's the 65-year-old lawyer that early in the book has lost his wife. He's lost three or four cases. He's working in a big uptown Charlotte law firm. But they're all about profits per partner now, and he hadn't been getting it done. So he gets kicked out of his law firm early in the book and finds himself stranded on what he thinks is a desert island at the Independence Retirement Community, where he thinks people are there to die, not live, and you know, have one foot in the grave and the other thinking about their next meal. And so he meets these two other residents that are very feisty. One's a 75-year-old fellow named Chuck Yeager Alexander, who is he's the comedic value for this book. He shoots fish and
Chuck is goals in life, just how he settled in.
Yeah, Chuck's got it going. And then you got Harriet Keaton. She's a very sturdy, very steady, you know, on-time, practical, former businesswoman. She keeps the men in line. And together, they entice Craig Travail to challenge the will on behalf of the granddaughter, because they think the granddaughter has been hoodooed by Sue Ellen Parker, who maybe took advantage of the professor to get all his money. And so they get him to go challenge the will in court. And he comes up with this great idea. Well, I know the professor, he was a best-selling author, and he, you know, he wrote this best-selling book showing that the Mech Deck is a hoax, and now he's shifted and thinks it's for real. And we'll just use that to show that he was kind of touched in the head and lacked testimony and capacity. And if we do that, we can show the will was invalid and everything will be fine. But then, as so happens along the way, the clues start popping up and things start happening, and they start to realize that they might be on a quest to solve a mystery that historians have not been able to solve for 250 years. And as they say on the cover, if they don't die trying.
Yeah, it's I finished it. You sent it to us a couple months ago, and I finished it. It was a really fun read, and I
thank you.
And especially it wasn't. You get a lot of like books based in history, like the Mechtek, and you can get bogged down into it, or you get, you know, books that are too fluffy and you don't feel like there's any substance. This is kind of firmly in the middle. So kudos to you and your writing. Going back to your style, you say you like to bring things from your personal life or experiences you've had. So you're saying you've had a boss who is almost evil and tied to a secretive organization. And if so, would you like to go on the record and say who?
You know, I think I'm still getting some, you know, like health benefits through my former law. I better not say anything. it's funny, you know, people say, well, Landis, you worked in a big law firm and you left at about age 64. And I said, yeah, but I didn't tackle my managing partner on the way out the door like Craig Travail. So it was totally different, you know. No, but I will say this, you know, I worked for a big law firm, McGuire Woods. They were good to me. But, you know, you can't help but, you know, when you're in a novel, you want to ramp things up, right? And I asked John Grisham at an event at Parker Books, I said, why do you always make the lawyers and the judges out to be crooks and thieves? And he said, well, you know, if I didn't do that, nobody would read the book. So, hey, I had to ramp it up a little bit, maybe, you know, make it exciting. But I do want to add one thing. You mentioned about, you know, all the history and moving fast. This is part of the writing process, because I mentioned getting all those words down. But I must have had 15, 20, 25 drafts of this book. And what I got early feedback was, when you do all this research, you actually put too much into the book initially. I had all these things in there about the history and things that were going back and forth, because I'd done all the work, right? I didn't want to not have it on the page. It was like 120, 30,000 words. But then after many more drafts, I was able to carve out enough to keep the history that was important, but make the pace such that people would enjoy it as a novel, but in the process, learn sort of the core aspects of what I wanted to get across.
Mission accomplished, I'd say. So other than kind of talking to Scott Seifert, like I'm curious, so you're familiar with our podcast and what we've done.
Right,
we've done history segments for 200 some, and we're big fans of Charlotte's history and kind of dig it into that. We feel like it's important to share the history of Charlotte, because it is a rich history, and MECDEC, you know where we stand on that. Very, very strong advocates, right? So what did you do to research? Was there any I get like strong National Treasure vibes, obviously, from Dudley Declaration. So I like to picture you like going through archives with a torch and stuff like that. But kind of what did you do to like do your own research about the history that kind of led you to have to whittle it down eventually?
Yeah, well, it's always nice to start out with a book like Scott's, where he's done most of the work for you already, right? And so I read that two or three times. I mean, the version I've got is dog-eared and tabbed in so many ways. And then I took what he did and I jumped off from there and actually looked at a lot of local sources. You know, there's the May 20th Society. They've got information on their website. There's the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Library. They've got a lot of good information. The Mecklenburg Historical Association. Then I started reading some of the books that were cited, you know, in Scott's book and some of the ones that were critical of the MECDEC history. And it was very interesting, because there are books all over the place, some that call the MECDEC spurious, like Thomas Jefferson did, others who are big champions of it and take the position of John Adams. So I thought, this is really cool. I'm finding out a lot of information. But I wanted to find out enough about the story to be able to write it. But as I said earlier, I still wanted it to be an interesting novel. And Charlotte is where I grew up. And because this was a story, it was kind of hiding, you know, history hiding in plain sight. Y'all do this on your podcast. I mean, things that we walk by every day, right? But it's here. And, of course, we're the city known for tearing things down, of course. So you have to look sometimes below the surface, which is where my next book may go, below the surface of Uptown with the old gold mines. But aside from that, you know, I love taking, you know, tying the contemporary mystery to the historical Charlotte, because it's kind of a way for me to learn more about my own city in the process and to go around and talk to people and say, hey, did you know this about Charlotte? Did you know that about Charlotte? When they say, no, I didn't, and they get interested, it's kind of like when I would watch a movie or read a historical fiction book. Used to be I'd go to the encyclopedia. We don't have those anymore. But now I'd go to Google and want to Google it, find out, did that really happen? Was that interesting? So when people tell me they've read the book and they immediately wanted to go Google the MEC deck and find out more, I feel like I've done my job there.
And you also make you – it's an anti-Thomas Jefferson book, and we're all for that.
Yeah, right. No spoilers, though.
Nope, we're not going to get into that. All right. Are you ready for some rapid-fire questions?
I suppose so, yes.
All right. John, I will say this. John has been messaging. So we have – let's go behind the curtain, which John hates when I do this. We have a Google Doc, and we type back and forth. We kind of questions and stuff we're working through. And John is just saying – I'm ready for rapid fire. I'm so excited. I now feel like there's expectations of me to have a.
It is. The bar is higher. I'm very high expectations for this. I'm very excited, and it's because like rapid fire is the best when the guest knows a lot about a lot of different things. So no pressure, Landis. But here we go. Well, take it away, Miller.
I was going to say, so that when there's a long pause, just edit that pause out, okay, so that it won't look.
Yeah, like that's right.
I'm taking 3 minutes to think about the answer.
All right. Do you believe in the MEC deck?
Absolutely.
What's your favorite candy?
Sweet tarts.
Is the Indy Aldersgate in the book?
If the people who go to Aldersgate like the book, then yes.
Do you want to read a paper book or read a book on a Kindle?
Both.
What does the typical Charlotte reader look like?
The typical Charlotte reader. You almost stumped me there. Someone who just loves to read.
Perfect. Should May 20th be a local civic holiday in Charlotte?
Absolutely.
Do you judge books by their covers?
I do.
If you had to steal the Declaration of Independence with Nicolas Cage, would you?
He would be a perfect choice.
Follow-up question. If you had to swap faces with Nicolas Cage, would you?
Depends on what age he is. Well, I guess given my age, of course, sure.
I will add another follow-up question. Nick Cage, great actor or greatest actor?
Great actor.
Okay. What time do you go to bed at night?
Y'all are pushing my bedtime here.
No, what time? All right, so let's get into this. Sidebar. What time are you in the process of getting ready to sleep?
Depends on if I'm writing or staying up late to watch a movie. But it's probably more like 11:30 at night. Yeah.
Oh, this isn't pushing it. This is 9:15 at night. Yeah. We're 15 minutes from my bedtime. What does it mean for Charlotte to be prime?
To be a city that wants to be recognized.
From my understanding, Deadly Decorations is a part of a series, correct?
Yes, it's just that I haven't got had time to write the.
When does the Charlotte podcast make an appearance?
Well, you know, I've got to figure out a way to work in a podcast in the next book, and it's not going to be mine. So you just gave me a great idea.
Have you thought of any Hamilton-esque raps for when Deadly Decorations is turned into a smash Broadway musical?
I don't think Chuck Yeager Alexander knows what a rap is, but if it's going to be a rap, I think it's going to have to be Harriet Keaton, and actually, it's probably going to have to be a couple of the eccentric characters at the Indy. Yeah. You know, the great thing about the Indy is there are always new people moving in, so there's probably going to be a rap artist who moves in.
The lady in the on the motorized scooter, yeah, she should do it.
NASCAR Nelly, known as Nelly Nimble, former correspondent who runs over old ladies because they just don't get out of the way in time.
Maybe this should be a country music musical. Yeah, all right.
I was thinking about putting a band, just a band in the next book, the Indy band.
All right, what is the best John Grisham book?
Time to Kill.
You said the MEC deck is real. What's your irrefutable evidence when someone says you're a liar?
Oral history. In I hate to have a long answer here, but in the legal world, when people say there's no proof of this, all they're really saying is there's not a document. And you don't have to have a document to win a lawsuit. You just have to have, good evidence. And, they had 15, 20 witness statements of people who were there. I kind of like oral history. Oral history tells a lot of the history of our nation.
Love this.
What's the motivation to lie also? Like, what's the motivation to lie? I don't get it.
They're shadowy organizations found in honor of our forefathers who should, you have to read the book to find out, John.
Exactly.
You've interviewed over 300 authors for your podcast. What is a question you wish you've asked that you haven't?
Oh, well, I've always been asked the question that I like to ask the most, the one that I probably should ask the question almost like the one you just asked, which is, what's a question that you haven't been asked about your book that you wish somebody had asked you?
All right. Follow-up question. What's the question you wish you'd been asked about your book that you haven't been?
I really set myself up for that, didn't I?
Yeah.
I suppose it has to do with, the question of how hard or easy was it really to write this book? And I would have to confess that it was a really hard thing to do. It was really a challenge, but that's what made it exciting. It was like trying to figure out if I could, do that thing. I'm not a marathon runner, but I would compare what writing a novel to kind of running a marathon figuratively. So, probably confessing to the fact that, it's not as easy as it might look.
As someone who has dabbled in running, and I think John has as well, we can confirm that writing a book is much harder than running a marathon, I would say. So what, you're Charlottean. What's one thing you wish people did more in Charlotte?
Probably, get together more often and not get too stuck in suburbia.
I feel like I'm being called out as the person who lives in suburbia on this podcast.
Seriously, Miller. Oh my God. Heed his advice, Miller.
Gosh, shots fired. Landis, you are officially off the hot seat.
Oh, wow, okay.
You did a fantastic job. I'm reading a note John wrote me, which is so good. Love it. Thanks, John. So where can people find your book? Where can they learn more? Obviously listen to the Charlotte Readers podcast, but specifically about the book. I saw it was in the Park Ridge bookstore recently. I was there the other day.
Yeah, it's at Park Ridge Books locally. It's also at Main Street Books if you're up in Davidson. If you're in Raleigh, Quail Ridge Books, it's kind of different bookstores across the state.
We don't have any Raleigh listeners. We banned this. We're banned.
Did you ban?
Yeah. They just get a dial tone if they turn it on.
But listen, you got to give them some credit because the story broke in the Raleigh Register about the Mech Deck in 1817. So had it not been for that, John Adams wouldn't have found about it in a Massachusetts newspaper. So we got to give them a little credit. They did
as little credit as possible.
For being haters. They do get credit for being haters. Fun.
So, but it's wherever books are sold. And you can, on my website, landiswade.com, all the information is there about the book. And check it out. And love to have more people read it and learn about Charlotte history and be amazed by that those things that you pass every day, that the Liberty Walk uptown, the Trail of History, the May 20th Society, go by Settler Cemetery, just, look around, look up, because when I didn't do that when I was practicing law, I'd run from one meeting to another on Tryon Street and never stop to look in the side mirror, kind of like my main character in the book here, and there's so much history, rich history we have in Charlotte.
Well, actually, let me throw out one last hot seat, then I'll let you go. May 20th is on a Friday this year. How are you celebrating?
Actually, I'll be at the square dressed as Captain James Jack at noon. When Robert Riles reads the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. So we will be there celebrating. This year it comes back to the square, so it's open to the public. Come on down, everybody who's listening, and you can celebrate the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence at the place where the log courthouse once stood in 1775.
John and I will be there. We'll be the ones loudly catcalling and making fun of Thomas Jefferson.
There you go. There you go. That would be fun.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you guys for what you do and for leading the way in Charlotte podcasting.
Awesome. Thank you, Landis. This is awesome.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
We're clear. You're good, Landis. Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Yeah. That was great.
That was awesome. Thanks so much for joining us. Like, love the book. And yeah, thanks for coming on, man.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. And, you know, what I was saying is I've done all these episodes and I think I've been on 15 or 20. And this is the latest I've ever recorded a podcast. And so I usually start drinking about 8 o'clock. I said, I better not do that, you know, because who knows what it'll be like by that time. So, but y'all are working real lives and everything. So you got to work it in, right?
Like, it's John's fault.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have to. My kids. I've got 3 young kids, so it's bedtime specific. But next time we'll have those drinks.
And, we'll do it in person
and see where it takes us. Yeah, exactly.
Let's do those things in person. I want to get back to where we have some, you know, events and things with the Queen City Podcast Network after COVID and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And when y'all write those books, you know, there's a place for you to come talk about them. So, you know.
My brain is gone. I can't write anymore. I write in 140 characters. That's all I have. That and press releases.
Coffee table book of Miller's tweets.
The shortest book ever written. Yeah.
All right, we're back. Just John and Miller. That was fun.
Yeah. You wrote some nice comments about him on a Google Doc.
I did. You love the peeks behind the curtain, man.
Because you hate it.
Yeah. I know. I should never have told you that. But yeah, I wrote you messages about how much I was enjoying that because I thought it was great. What a cool book. I'm so glad that it exists. I hope it gets turned into a movie. Wouldn't that be exciting?
It is. Also, I checked. We have no iTunes reviews, so if you want to leave us sweet notes, do it on iTunes, or you can email us. It's thecharlottepodcast@gmail.com. sorry, I should have mentioned that at the beginning of the episode. It is officially 9:30. The running joke is that this is now the time I'm usually asleep, so you have now zombie Miller. Here's a question for you, John. How many hours of sleep do you need a night? Like, consistently.
Me personally or humans?
You.
Me?
Yeah. Like, how many, all right, if I'm hitting this amount, I'm good.
Okay. Pre-kids, that number was, like, at least 7, probably 7.5 hours a night.
Same.
Post-kid, what?
Same.
Yeah. Post-kids, I mean, in turn, just for me to be functional, is that the question?
Yeah, to function. And these is, like, 5 days in a row. If you got this 5 days in a row, the sixth day you're still alive.
All right. If that's the bar, if the bar is that low, and I could just like go to work Monday through Friday and nobody would tell a difference, I'm not even joking. It's like 4 hours a night. Mm-hmm. I could pull that off.
Yeah, I think I'm 5 to 6.
I feel like I have 3 boys, ages 8 and younger. I feel like I've been through Navy SEAL boot camp, like, because with the sleep over the last couple of years.
Here's a question for you. Are any of the kids good sleepers?
Kind of age specific. They're all kind of fine now, but like they've all been bad sleepers at one point in their lives.
Was there a point when good sleep was happening at your house all at the same time? Maybe when you had your first child, was it
like now, maybe?
Okay.
It's been 8 years. It's 8 long, long years.
Help. My family's keeping me alive by keeping me awake all the time.
I gotta pay the piper at some point. Everybody's like, oh, it's so like, oh, can you believe they're like 7 or 8 years old? I'm like, yes, I've been awake for 20 hours a day for 8 years. Yeah, I can. It has felt. I've felt every hour that they've been that age. So, yeah.
Felder said on his podcast, Hand in the Dirt, which he was just like, all I just want in life is just quiet. It's like, I just want silence. He's like, I'm just surrounded by noise at all times. It's like,
you know what I want? I'd want that, but second to that would be like validation that the noise, that my desire for that is justified. By which I mean, Like, you know, the show like Wife Swap, where they just like film you, your family, and you got like a weirdo family, and then you switch places with the family that's opposite of you.
Yeah.
Like, I just want like on national TV to like see how insane dinner is at my house and like how my kids behave so that everyone just knows that it's not me that is the problem.
Okay. Let me like, ask you this.
When I leave my house.
This is kind of leading to something I want to talk about with parents.
Okay.
We have one. We have another on the way.
Congrats.
We're very excited and we know we're about to get rocked. Obviously,
yeah,
completely different. We've forgotten
a lot. Maybe not though.
Yeah, you've met Asher. He is just
seems great.
He's just a very like my son, who's 2.5, sleeps well, very calm, like just like a loving boy, very little issues. Should I feel guilty about that?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. And I don't ever, when I talk about my own life, I don't ever say it to like elicit sympathy or make people feel bad that their kids are not that way or anything like that. It is entirely just like, it's not even like help. It's just like, this is my life. The kids are absolute maniacs. Like,
I think we've talked about this. We might be repeating ourselves. I don't know. It's zombie.
Yeah. Killer. I don't know.
But no, yeah. I just like, and also I know, I feel like everything's like a pendulum. Like eventually, like it will swing back the other way and everything equals out in life.
Oh yeah. I mean, my kids will be like pinning their Harvard essays while Asher is, I don't know what he's doing. Like jumping 50 school buses.
Going on a motorcycle or something. Harvard by the highway, guest in college.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Which was a great nickname for a guest in college that we referred to it in high school, Harvard by the Highway.
Do you think nicknames like that are still happening in places like the greater Charlotte area? I feel like really creative nicknames like that, like they had a heyday in like the 70s and 80s, but they don't really happen anymore. What do you think of that?
For community colleges or just like rant general things?
Just like places like that, like, because they're like, it's not necessarily something that's offensive, but you are like making fun of something for not being Harvard, right?
Yeah.
So like, is there anything new like that? Can you still tell, like, nickname a large person tiny and everybody thinks it's funny? Like, not that I'm like anti-cancel culture or like anything like that. I'm just saying, like, can you call a community college Harvard by the Highway? Or like where I'm from, there's this town, Culpeper. And there's a Germana Community College. And so everybody would say like, oh yeah, I'm going to USC. And they call it like University of Southern Culpeper. It was this community college. So it's like, that's really funny, right? Like everyone loves those jokes.
It's not like...
but like, do people still do that? Are there new ones being created?
Also, my mother taught there. Like, I don't have any issues with it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's a great thing for the community. I think it's also like maybe it's like a very specific time to when we grew up. Like there was an IHOP on Cox Road and no one ever referred to him going to IHOP. It was always IHOP on Cox. That was just like the name of it from the moment it was built to today, and be like, I would never call it IHOP. It's always IHOP on Cox.
I think that's the answer then, is like, so that is still happening, but it's happening in like the milieu of like texts and like social media, right? So like it probably exists. So like, that's a good example of like, I hop on Cox, is like, you would text that to like the group chat with a question mark, right? And everybody would know what you were talking about. And it's just kind of like an inside joke. So that's probably how it proliferates now, as opposed to like an uncle who says it and everybody laughs and like he thinks he's really funny, which is how it happened in the 80s, right?
Yeah, I think, there is funny stuff in group text. We should consider, like, I don't know, I told you I'm a zombie now. We should think about if we ever want to do like a Discord channel or something like that, where just friends of the podcast could,
a Telegram, so that we can't be tracked like ISIS. Good idea.
What? Just call people
like Telegram channels.
But yes, I know
it's saying,
Telegram.
I'm saying using, I'm just saying like lots of terrorists use Telegram. That's all I'm saying.
Why did you go and call our listeners ISIS?
I didn't say they were ISIS. I just said like similarly, we could set up a Telegram channel.
Our podcast Telegram, or our podcast ISIS adjacent Telegram channel.
I mean, it's a platform. It's a platform that is like intentionally like caters to organizations like ours and ISIS. I'm just saying it's appealing to many.
Sorry, I coughed in the mic.
This is great pod. You coughing in the microphone. Calling everybody terrorists.
Sorry.
It's funny, I don't think this has happened like 260 episodes.
We're gonna get shadow banned we're gonna get canceled finally. Thank God.
Finally.
Maybe that's how
our misery.
That's how this podcast ends.
Sorry, Landis.
Landis, you are wonderful. We're now getting canceled after your interview to end it. John, cheers. What's a cheer?
Hey, so Charlotte is a really convenient city. Let's not lose sight of it, is what I say. That's my cheers of the week.
Last time you were complaining about how transportation's horrible.
It is, but I think it's relative. Like, that's the whole point of what I want to say, is like, it's not perfect. Like, two things can be true at once, Miller. Like, I think we can just do what we need to do to get it right, make things better, but I love that you can have a giant event, and that's, again, not perfect. Like Kenny Chesney, Billy Joel, like big sporting events, everything pretty easy to get to. It's not an hour and a half of like drive and sit in your car like it is in many other places. Yeah. And let's just appreciate that.
That's good. No, I think it's good. I think Uptown is such a big asset. And I think getting most anywhere is more bearable than other places, but it, particularly like the Uptown is a very big asset for Charlotte, especially when it comes, and I'm in the live event business, but it is something that other cities do not. Like, we directly compete with other cities. We talk about how our Uptown's better.
We need more better infrastructure that serves more people, period, and people on different areas of the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yes.
And all of that needs to happen. But still, if you're like trying to go to a concert in Uptown, it's going to take 20% of the time that it takes in any other city on the Eastern Seaboard. So let's appreciate that. So jeers this week.
Okay.
We got a little preview of it today, but humidity's right around the corner, man.
Yeah.
I'm so not looking forward to it.
I was walking by. There's a couple. We walk. We do a walk every night after dinner. Sorry, this will be a long story that's pointless.
Go on.
Welcome to our podcast. There's a circle that we always walk, or a loop. It's and they walk the opposite way, and we always pass them. And today, or no, it was yesterday. He was like, "How are we shows weather like this all the time?" I'm like, well, next week it's not going to be, because summer is here. He looked at me and he realized that he is about to sweat his ass off. It's like, yeah, it's coming, my friend.
Yeah, I know.
We kind of missed like nice spring weather. Like, we're in, summer's here.
Yeah, I'm hoping it like switches back. Like, today was bad. And I feel like the past 2 years, like, that's a little silver lining of the pandemic and kind of like being at home for a while. Like, people
the
forget
the rising global core that's slowly killing the planet.
Yeah, and all of that. Yeah, absolutely. But like, May 2020 was like some of the nicest weather that I've ever experienced in Charlotte. So people sleep on how nice the weather was in May 2020.
I feel like April
in Charlotte.
April's usually super nice, and it was not this year.
It was warmer than usual, I believe. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's right around the corner. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm not going to make a prediction, but like, you get to May and it's great. Be excited about the summer for many, many reasons, but man, the humidity, I could do without.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially you're going back. You have to dress up for your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's
for the most part. Yeah. Not as laid back as you wearing your white jeans and a Luke Kuechly jersey.
Yeah, it's my Lululemon pants and the same.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, man. Lululemon pants, a pair of Nike shoes, and a button-up rolled up to the sleeves. That's who I am.
It is.
I was going to ask you something.
The Miller uniform. All right. I know you need to go to sleep 12 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So should we wrap this up?
Let's not woo too loud. One, two, three. Woo!
Whoa. Was that too quiet?
I don't know. I'm now thinking about how we're all going to die from global warming or climate change or whatever we call it these days. Good night, sweet prince.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.